now we're joined by the Elephant Partnership with Henrik Paul Foundation for this second phase of the series. As Patrick has said earlier, this is a recap forum looking back at the elections that took place in 2020 in the region, Uganda and Tanzania in particular, and looking forward to the elections that are upcoming in 2021, namely Ethiopia, Somalia, Somaliland. In the run-up to these critical elections this year and some spilling over to 2022, the series intends to provide a long-term view on the democratic development of the region by providing critical analysis and space for debate on the pertinent issues during this period. The discussions round will be centered around and we'll look at the impact of online activism and internet shutdowns, protests, securitization and militarization of the polls, the media's role, the participation of women, and ethnic conflicts and the legacy of election-related violence. Our moderator today is Patrick Gadara, who's a political commentator, illustrator, and as he described himself, he describes himself a noisemaker, whom we do love here in Kenya. And it's also part of the Elephant. My name is Pauline Otieno-Skaipa, and I'm the forum manager here at the Rift Valley Institute. The forum is a program of the Rift Valley Institute and is a neutral platform that is dedicated to critical exploration, discussion, and debate on important political, economic, and social issues within the Horn and Eastern Africa. Without further ado, Patrick.
All right. Thanks a lot for that, Pauline. And thanks, everybody, for joining in. We today have a really great panel. My name is Patrick Gadara. I am the chief curator at The Elephant, which is a platform basically for reimagining how Kenya works, how the region works, how Africa works. And in the context of this conversation, I think it's really important for us to think about how elections work within East Africa. There's quite a number that have happened, quite a number that are coming up. Are they necessary? Do we need them? Are they a good idea? How can we do them better? I'm really glad to be joined in this session by at least four panelists. I think one of them is trying to log in, Kalundi Sarumaga. Hopefully he'll be in. But I'll just introduce the guys that we have at the moment. I'll start with Fatma Karume from Tanzania, who is presently a non-practicing barrister. She lives in Tanzania. There's a quote I have from her, which I thought was really excellent for this discussion. She says that those who suggest that there's a democracy for the West and one for Africa have failed to understand that the universality of the human condition. So is there such a thing as an African democracy, as many people like to tell us? We're also joined by Adem Abebe, who supports transitions to peace and democracy in politically complex and fragile contexts as part of the constitution building team of the international IDEA, including in South Sudan, Ethiopia, Sudan, Somalia, and the Gambia. Adem serves as a member of the executive committee of the African Network of Constitutional Law and in the advisory board of the International Journal of Constitutional Law. We're also joined by Omar Mahmoud, who's a senior analyst for Somalia with the International Crisis Group based in Nairobi. He previously worked as a senior researcher focusing on the Horn of Africa for the Institute for Security Studies in Addis Ababa and is an international consultant covering Boko Haram and the Lake Chad Basin. We'll be joined later on by Kalundi Sarumaga, who's a writer, playwright, social critic based in Kampala, Uganda, and one of the major contributors to The Elephant. Right, so perhaps we could start with you, Fatma, and you could tell us what you think about what the elections that happened in Tanzania. Are they better elections than before? Has there been an improvement? And what is the scope for actually improving the electoral system there? Are there still challenges, by the way, going on? What's going on there?
I think if we go back to the 2020 elections, they were a travesty in Tanzania. We actually did not have elections. We had a system of appointments, to be quite frank with you. When I say that, why do I say that? I start off from the party level, which is, you know, the ruling party level, CCM, Chama Cha Mapinduzi. Even in their preliminary nomination process, the chairman of the party, the then chairman of the party, Magufuli, decided exactly who he wanted to represent the party. Thereafter, what happened? There were certain groups or people who he wanted to go through without challenge. And what happened was the National Electoral Commission made sure that all the members of the opposition who were running for the constituencies which in which Magufuli's people were chosen, for example, the present Minister of Foreign Affairs, Kabudi, the Speaker of Parliament, these were, they were really Magufuli cronies, and he wanted to make sure that they went through without any challenge. And our National Electoral Commission disqualified all members of the opposition running in those constituencies where Magufuli's cronies were running. And they were disqualified for things like filling in a form allegedly wrongly. So if you filled in the form and ticked the wrong box, or you didn't put the date, you didn't date it correctly, you would be disqualified. Whilst the constitution says that, you know, to be a member of parliament, you have to have, you should not have a criminal record, you have to be over 21, you have to be a national. Those things didn't matter anymore. We went down to technicalities and the use of technicalities to make sure that the election was won before the people of the country even cast their votes. This to me was unacceptable, because it was taking technicalities to a level of injustice. So when I say we didn't have elections, I mean that the National Electoral Commission ensured that they packed everything in favor of the ruling party. And as a result, we have a parliament which is 99% ruling party. Can you imagine? and the president won by, I don't know, what does it matter? 82%, I can't remember anymore, because frankly, it does not matter. 82%, it's never happened. Or 87%, God only knows. It's never happened in the history of Tanzania during multi-party elections. But you know, they handed him the victory. As you all know, our president passed away we were informed he passed away on the 17th of March. So we are now moving on to a new administration, and we will see what comes out of that. But frankly speaking, I don't expect things to change much, because it's an institutional issue. It's a systemic problem, and it's the system that needs to be changed.
Oh, thanks for that, Fatma. That's a nice overview. We'll come back to discuss the institutional issues, the issues with the constitution, etc. And obviously the new president is female. We'll be talking a little bit about the role of women, not just in Tanzania, but across the region. Kalundi, if you can hear me, perhaps you could talk to us about what's happening in Uganda. Just an update of what's happened since the elections, obviously President Museveni was re-elected. We know there was quite a lot of violence associated with that. There was quite a lot of detentions and disputes, and I think the election is being challenged in court, if I'm not wrong. So if you could just give us an update of what's going on there. And for any of you who haven't seen it, Kalundi has done a very interesting article in the Elephant on this issue, where he actually says for elections to succeed in East Africa, the people have to be destroyed in the form that they are. So perhaps he could also speak a little bit to what he means by that. Go on, Kalundi.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much, and greetings to everybody. I was just wondering if I could just smuggle in a quick question to Fatima there. she is who she is. And our fathers might have actually been known to each other, but never mind that. I was wondering to what extent one might revisit the whole question of the Federation of Tanganyika and Zanzibar as a route to why we can never have proper elections, certainly not in Zanzibar. Because my own understanding and analysis of it, and I once attended a conference in Dar, I believe it was the same question, was that it wasn't so much a federation as Tanganyika swallowing up Zanzibar on behalf of the Americans, because they were scared it was going to become a Cuba. And this is after the revolution, and I'm wondering if one can ever expect democracy if that is inherently an unstable arrangement. There were Tanganyikan activists demanding a Tanganyikan parliament as opposed to the so-called national parliament. If it is actually supposed to be a federation of the two, because Zanzibar has a parliament. Now, anyway, hopefully I'll get an answer to that. But
we'll have a discussion after I've had the whole overview from yourself, from Adebe, from Mahmoud, and then we can get into the meat of these discussions.
Excuse my indiscipline. let me now get to the point. It's the usual thing that first of all, we have to be very careful with language. There are no winners and losers in the Ugandan election scenario. You have a person declared the winner, and you have other people declared the losers. This has no bearing on whether or not you have actually, the person declared actually won. So I never say when I'm writing or speaking, I try to avoid, which is very common in the media, saying that the president won the election or was declared, was made the winner, whatever. It was simply a declaration. The usual things are happening with a lot more intensity and greater spread. There's widespread persecution of alleged supporters of the ruling party or the losing party, that is Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform. A lot of arrests, detentions, beatings, some murders in detention, some murders out of detention. He went through the usual thing that Besigye used to go through. If you remember Colonel Besigye from the previous elections, of being confined to his house, people not being let in or out. The escalation here was maybe that even the American ambassador wasn't let in the first time she went there. But then later on, they did the usual thing of the whole Western embassy convoy going and parking his compound and then talking to him, which shows that if you're going to lose an election to President Museveni in this country as a candidate, you must first have a house with a big enough compound to accommodate the entire EU delegation when they come in their SUVs to sit around with you and ask you, what are you going to do next? When they're the ones funding this mess. Now, it's going to just continue like that until swearing in. That is what normally happens. There was a court case. The problem was that the Chief Justice, because these cases are heard, I think, at the level of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice currently today used to be an ruling party MP. And at some point down the line, in one of the election campaigns, there was, of course, a petition against President Museveni being declared winner again. And at that time, the man who's Chief Justice now was one of the lead lawyers on the NRM Museveni side, defending him against that particular petition. So this particular petitioner said that you're biased and you should accuse yourself. And the Chief Justice lost it and abused him and even accused him of things he hadn't done. He said, if you don't like the court, go to your plan B. Bobi Wine Chagulani has never said he has a plan B. That was a statement that came from Besigye in a slightly different context. So it showed a bias. Anyway, at some point he decided to withdraw the case. And then there was an argument, is the court going to allow him to withdraw the case? Finally, they allowed him to withdraw the case. And then what happened after that is that there was supposed to be a formal ruling given anyway. And on allowing the case to be withdrawn and what all the judges thought, and a fight broke out between the Chief Justice and the lady justice on the bench called the Chisache, who was not allowed to read her minority reports. So what happened in court was that the microphone was switched off and the file was confiscated. And the ruling party lawyers walked out, and all the other members of the bench also walked off the bench and left her sitting there by herself. She described the Chief Justice's behavior as barbaric. And that's where we are. What this gentleman has managed to do is poison all branches of the states. Parliament was a long time ago poisoned through being bribed and then being physically beaten into adjusting the constitution to allow him to keep standing for various terms. Of course, he poisoned the executive by simply sitting there. And then he has poisoned the judiciary to the extent that an open fight can break out between judicial members on the bench. As I say, after the swearing in, when and if it takes place, there will then be possibly a bit more persecutions. The whole thing is to keep the whole idea is to keep a lid on the entire situation until they feel that it has run out of energy. And then we can all go back to normal, which is living with this kind of situation of poverty and lack of policy planning and so on and so forth. But my essential point is this, that none of these states were designed to be democratic, and we need to understand that. Okay, this is okay. Number one. And just to conclude on that one. In the entire colonial period, we had exactly two elections, one on the year before independence and the second one on the year of independence. We had never had these kind of elections before. You cannot allow a machine that is designed to extract by displacing and dispossessing to give a voice to the people it is displacing and dispossessing, because they will vote for the wrong people. They'll vote for someone who tells them to get out and to possibly dismantle even that state. And I don't think that until we address, we don't need new governments in East Africa. We need new states, okay? And I think these are states that need to be sensitive to the various community representations. If you can't do that, you must destroy the communities and turn us all into individuals who are concerned about my income tax, will it be higher or lower this year, and things like that. But as long as you have communities with legitimate collective senses of grievance and this desire for the wealth of this region all up and down the Nile Valley, I don't think you can have democracy. You can have this drama, which is very good to keep a section of the middle class distracted. It's a way a lot of people make money out of it. It allows the donors to pretend that they're bringing something, but it reaches a point where it becomes a crisis in itself, and we can't move beyond that. And this is a point I've been repeatedly trying to make. I'm not saying there are no benefits. People participate. Ugandans have always wanted to participate right from the 1920s, when the British banned even Ugandans from forming cooperative societies, when we were not allowed to be in the so-called legislative council they had created for themselves. Only some Asians and a few white people were. There's always been a need for democracy. So the problem was that once you created this pretense in the 1995 constitution, Ugandans took it seriously. And this is what has created the political crisis, because now they have voted for somebody whom the state doesn't want and cannot accommodate, because they don't know what he wants to do with his constituents, who are the young people of this country. And so we have to have this crisis every 5 years because of this. That's all for now.
All right, thanks a lot for that. Kalundi, that's a nice overview. Adem, I know you have to take off just for a short while. Do you want to give just a short overview of what's in Ethiopia, or would you like to do that afterwards?
No, I can do that. I can try and do it quickly.
Yeah, right.
So coming in the background of my colleagues from Tanzania and Uganda speaking about what happened, and in me trying to think about what could happen, it's very difficult. So it's obviously they're very pessimistic about it, and I hope that Ethiopia will avoid at least the nightmarish possibility. It's difficult in the sense that there is as some of you may know a security. A massive security problem, particularly in the north of the country, but broadly across the country. Economically, it's highly indebted, and the country is expected to pay about $5 billion in the coming months. And that obviously affects the way things happen. And politically, it's extremely divided, particularly along ethnic lines, but also within ethnic groups. And I think what Kalundi said about some of the points in terms of how we think as a community and perhaps even killing that so that we start thinking as individuals, we are not there yet. And in fact, often the problem in Ethiopia is is drawn as a contradiction between two narratives. One that sees the individual essentially at the center of the political system, and another that sees groups, particularly linguistic groups, as at the basis of the political organization. And we are going to elections within this context of a division of ideas, unraveling security situation, and very, very difficult economic conditions. And as you can imagine, the preparations are going on. Candidates have been registered, but unfortunately, some of the main opposition parties, particularly in the biggest region of the country, in Oromia, have threatened, essentially, they're going to boycott it. And what that means is that the credibility, competitiveness, fairness of the elections, it has already been affected, right? The perceptions are already taking shape before things even happen. So now the biggest fear, I don't think a lot of people consider the elections. I think it's going to be a good exercise, as currently say, people want to participate and all. But in terms of impact, in terms of actually leading to a different kind of outcome, I have a lot of doubts. And in fact, now the biggest challenge is about holding peaceful elections. So if we manage to hold peaceful elections, I think that would be a massive achievement. Forget its competitiveness and forget its credibility. I'll stop there.
Adam, if I may just have a quick follow-up. If elections don't look like they're going to have much of an impact and all you want for them to be peaceful, are they just ritual exercises? Is there any value to them?
I think there's value in them. And I think, thank you, because I think I must expand. When in 2008, when the change within the ruling party happened and the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came, there was a lot of expectations. And the elections will not, they're not going to meet that expectation. But the exercise itself is critical, and that's one, in the sense that one, at least some of the parties are actively involved, trying to show that there is a system, there is an institutional structure where they can express or at least mark their differences with the ruling party. And we also have an extremely committed electoral board, electoral commission, that is trying its best to build first itself as an institution, and second, also support the main actors that are contesting for power. So I don't want to dismiss it as a pure folly, but what I'm trying to say is that the expectations were quite high. This was supposed to be the election that transcends the country from authoritarianism, from conflict, to relative peace and relative democracy. And that is very unlikely to happen. But I cannot say it's not valuable. It is important. And of course, the question is, if not elections, then what? So we have to have elections. The question should not be whether we should have them. The question should be, how can we make them better? And I hope we'll discuss more of that in the coming minutes. Thank you.
All right. Omar, how does it look like in Somalia? I know you're in Nairobi, but that's your area of expertise. What do you think of, does any of what you hear sound familiar when it comes to Somalia?
Yeah, so I mean, Somalia is an interesting case because we don't have elections in the sort of traditional sense. These are really more indirect elections or really selections when it comes down to it. You know, I think the starting point is to really realize that these elections in 2020, 2021 were supposed to be the first one person, one vote elections in Somalia since 1969. You know, you're in a context where state institutions are still being rebuilt. And so it's been decades, you know, entire generations haven't gone through that electoral exercise. You know, unfortunately, that's not the case this time around. You know, there's a number of reasons for that, but I'd say lack of preparation for this really monumental task. The preparation didn't really meet the task. And so rather we've defaulted back to indirect elections once again. And so what that means in the Somali context is actually a very small amount of people participate. And it's organized around the sub-clan units, which choose electoral colleges that are supposed to be representative, which go on to choose members of parliament. So if in the 2017 elections, about 14,000 people participated, that's going to double this time which is, you know, an achievement, but then really you're looking at only 28,000 people participating in the election. And so that's kind of, you know, a bit of a different take in terms of where Somalia is. Unfortunately, right now, the process is stalled over the implementation of some of these electoral agreements between the political elites. It's gotten quite contested, and I think the level of distrust is actually higher than in the past elections for numbers of reasons we can discuss, but it's really hindered implementation to the point where we're actually at an unprecedented situation right now in Somalia, where the constitutionally the mandates of the current government have expired, but there's no plan on the way forward. You know, timeline's not always a huge issue in Somalia because mandates have expired in the past, but there's always been a plan on the way forward, and right now there's not. So really, it's almost kind of day to day or hour to hour that there's various meetings going on that are the hopes are raised and then they're dashed, and we've gotten stuck in this repetitive cycle. But unfortunately, there's a little bit of limbo, and it's very unclear how this is going to go forward and whether this is really contributing, because, you know, Somalia is in the case where you're still rebuilding the institutions, you're still rebuilding the state. You know, elections in the past have, at least for all their faults, provided a means of rotating power at the highest level. So there is some value in that. But another indirect process, does that really, you know, achieve and tie into some of these wider state building agendas and aims is I think something we can discuss further.
Yeah, if I may just ask about the aspiration for basically one man, one vote elections in Somalia. One of the reasons why elections are held, in essence, or why they are privileged around the world, is they're supposed to lend legitimacy to governing structures and to state. But it seems to me that given Somalia's history, especially in the last decade of having peaceful handovers of power that seem to be accepted by the populace, and then looking across the rest of the region where you have one man, one vote elections that don't really deliver this legitimacy, is it something that perhaps Somalia should rethink as an aspiration, that maybe there are other ways of having legitimate governments that essentially don't result from one man, one vote elections?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because the one thing that Somalia has done well is rotate that power at the top leadership. But I think you'd have to go back, if, for example, look at the 2017 election. You know, prior to the presidential vote, when you were looking at the voting for parliament, you were looking at the organization around these electoral colleges and whatnot. I mean, there was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of vote buying. You know, it's hard to say really that represented any sort of legitimate process in itself. It was really representing the population as well within that, you know. And so I think once it came to the parliament's election of the presidency, that was, you know, sort of the saving grace of that election, in that it did show that you could have a parliament that votes against the incumbent, and that the power is rotated peacefully and whatnot. But again, you know, was that really representative of the wider population? You know, there was a lot of support at the time when President Farmaja was elected, but there was also a lot of money that went into that process and a lot of outside external influence that ties into that as well. You know, especially when you have an indirect process that's so closed, you get a lot of undue influence, whether that's from candidates who see a way of influencing just a small amount of population to get themselves in office, from external actors, which see the same thing. You know, I mean, if you influence, you put a little bit of money in the process and influence a few actors, you can get an ally in Mogadishu for the next, you know, 4 years or so. So, you know, I think that is the one thing Somalia has done well, and it's interesting to reflect on that and to maybe expand the system while still keeping at least that norm in process. But at the end of the day, I think it's hard to say that those cycles that we've seen were still that legitimate, that representative of the wider population. You know, and given that they were still so closed, I still think there's value to open that up. And you know, maybe that doesn't necessarily have to be all of a sudden you go from a small process to one person, one vote in one cycle. Maybe there's a phased approach to that, and you kind of develop these norms as you go.
Okay. I don't want to miss out on the question that Kalundi had asked Fatma. So perhaps you could, Fatma, did you get it, or do you want to rephrase it?
No, I got it. Okay. I wrote it down. Thank you. So I maybe think what's going to Hi, Kalundi. First of all, Kalundi, I'd like to be a little bit to have a little bit of indiscipline like you did as well, and to agree with you entirely that none of these states, with your comment that none of these states were designed to be democratic, you're absolutely 100% right. Particularly the states, when we look at the states that later joined the Commonwealth, which were the result of colonialism through the from the United Kingdom, we have to understand that they were set up actually to ensure the continuation of the crown, the power of the crown over us in the form of if you look at our constitutions, in the form of the crown being at the top, and then we had a prime minister. And the prime minister, the crown was represented by the governor, who had immense power. And that was a continuation we were supposed to go along that track. Unfortunately, I don't know which one it is, our leaders cottoned on very quickly, got rid of the crown and crowned themselves, basically, and they became monarchs through the concept. They told us that we were going to go into a republic, and we got very, very excited. We would no longer have a monarch, and they crowned themselves as presidents. And that's why we have in Tanzania what we call an imperial presidency. Now, you asked the question whether Federation of Zanzibar and Tanganyika would assist to form free and fair elections, Kalundi. It's not the structure. The structure of the union has its challenges. There's no doubt about that. But the structure of the union is not the reason why Zanzibar doesn't have free and fair elections. It is really the structure of governance in Tanzania. And someone has asked about the deep state. And basically, the deep state is nothing more than the people with the guns and the power that want to continue the status quo and who do not truly believe in the will of the people and do not want to give power back to the people, because somehow they have managed to subvert the will of the people and to retain power amongst a very small group of people. And this power is shared, and they don't want to give it back to the people. Because after all, what is democracy? Democracy is nothing more, and this is why, you know, I keep saying this, that you can't say there's an African democracy and a European democracy. If you understand the human condition, all democracy is, it is really the right of the people to appoint their own representatives to run state institutions for and on their behalf. If you take that away from the people, then what you've done is you have given that power to a very limited group of people. And unfortunately, I find this is what's been happening in the majority of the countries in Africa. It's a small group of people who keep wanting to retain this power. And all elections are they use elections to legitimize their retention of power. And I do agree with Kalundi on this. Every election cycle is a crisis cycle. And the only reason it's a crisis cycle is because there are few people who want to dislodge the will of the people and who want to take over the power, state power, and to abuse state power in order to continue to obtain and retain the state power in the hands of a few people. And this is why we keep getting crisis after crisis every time we go into elections. And it will result in voter apathy. Either we will have voter apathy, or we will go into bigger and bigger crisis cycles until there is for example, what happened in Kenya. There is blood loss. And the blood loss is going to be, unlike in Uganda and in Tanzania, what's been happening is that the state has been killing voters and the people. At some point, they're going to lose that control. And so something has to give. This cannot go on forever.